Hello and good evening. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutin.
Welcome to Consider This. This is the show where we want you to consider and then reconsider what you know of the news of the day. Schools in Malaysia are set to reopen October 3rd after nearly 35 weeks of being shuttered. Now, according to data from the UNESCO Institute for Statistics, Global Monitoring of School Closures Caused by COVID, we've had one of, if not the longest, school closures in the world. Now, as schools reopen, it's vital that authorities assess the magnitude of learning loss so that we're able to implement the appropriate remedial measures. Measuring learning loss, of course, is the critical first step towards mitigating its consequences. Now, over the past 17 months, how effective has PDPR been? Of course, PDPR, better known in Malaysia, often referred to Malaysia, SPTPR, that's home-based teaching and learning. And Dr. M. Niaz Asadullah in January completed a study to measure the efficacy of PDPR. He titled the study Homeschooling During the COVID-19 Pandemic. Dr. M. Niaz Asadullah is a professor of economics at University of Malaya. He's also the co-editor of the International Journal of Educational Development. And he joins us on the show today. Hi, Niaz. Thank you so much for being with us on the show today. I'm just, you know, wondering about this survey, because many of the findings of your survey, they weren't surprising. They were things that we knew were issues being faced by learners and teachers and parents about PDPR. So now that we've talked a lot about the efficacy of PDPR, I'm just wondering what about the findings did surprise you the most in terms of scale of the learning loss or the absenteeism? Maybe you can share with us at the start of this conversation.
Thanks again for having me, Melissa. And so you're right that there are a number of findings that kind of confirm what we already know, such as learning opportunities at home in Malaysia are highly unequal, be that in terms of access to learning materials, books, availability of education technology. But at the same time, what we have also learned is that there is huge inequality in terms of the support that learners receive from family members, father, mother, and siblings. But I suppose the one that was really surprising was how irregular online lessons were. So under PDPR, school authorities were in charge of delivering regular daily lessons online to students. As per my data, 24% schools did not offer these lessons. And so for another equal proportion, it was not regular. So that means that, you know, even the promise of PDPR, which is learning continuity from the school authority for children at home, didn't occur. So this was, you know, the first main headline message, which is hinting at governance failure. But the other part is that it's not just the quantitative shortfall in online lesson delivery. There is also a question of quality. A large proportion of students, 47%, did not see any program of, you know, online program under PDPR scheme. And among those that attended these programs, 34% did not find them easy to follow. So this is again raising question about the effectiveness of the lessons that were being made available to students and students who actually attended these programs. But the third really headline message, therefore, is that given the, you know, less than universal coverage of online schooling on one hand and the unequal opportunities at home to learn on the other hand, all students are really looking forward to returning to school. I asked a question directly whether students wanted to continue in education in 2021. 92% said that they have no intention of discontinuing education. But among those, 80% want a return to on-site education. 65% want full-time return to on-site education. Another 15% prefer a hybrid form of education. So that's a good summary of the main headline messages.
So, Niaz, can we take that first headline, the idea that, in fact, the Ministry of Education did not deliver universal homeschooling in terms of this PDPR, initiative? How was it justified? I mean, have you spoken to the ministry? Did they explain why a quarter of schools didn't actually provide these lessons? And what was the thinking behind this failure to provide the service?
I suppose this has been a surprising finding, and I'm sure the ministry wasn't aware, because there was this element of trust. The government trusted teachers and schools to deliver, follow the PDPR guideline, and there was also this big assumption that parents at home would collaborate with teachers to make PDPR a success. And I suppose that's where, it kind of, the plan, didn't quite work. And there is, again, another side to it, which is that the government didn't have a provision to gather regular real-time data on teachers and learners to monitor whether lessons were taking place on a regular basis. So this, again, it highlights another side to the PDPR scheme, ignoring the behavioral vulnerabilities. The fact that, we are in times of crisis, teachers and learners are both in distress. Someone has a sick family member, someone may have a family member who has lost a job. So in such distressing time, and of course there are other challenges of, unstable internet. So in such, time, there can be lapses in service delivery. And what is necessary is a very strong governance structure to ensure management and compliance. And that was really, for me, the missing element of PDPR.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. When we talk about PDPR, I mean, a lot of the analysis has been focused on the digital gap, which is real and needs to be addressed. But I think also you're right about the burden that has been shifted from teacher to family in trying to carry out PDPR at home. So I want to talk a little bit about that. It was quite... I'm sure must have been very overwhelming for many families, many parents, to have suddenly the educational responsibility shifted onto them. Can we talk a little bit about what was done to prepare families and parents for this? According to your survey, I think about a third, so 29% of students got help from their mothers, and 27 said of older siblings. And this seems like a very heavy burden for particularly women who are probably, this adding to unpaid care work, double burden for working mothers. Can we talk a little bit about the family support and the role of parents and the challenges at home?
That's an excellent question. But let me also put this in context. The whole idea of PDPR is to, make sure that schooling continues. But, when we think of schooling, it's much more than teachers and classrooms. It's about structure, it's about discipline, monitoring mechanism in place within which students and teachers interact. But let's also not forget friends, which all, when put together, ensure an enabling environment for education in classroom. And that's when learning becomes fun and joyful. Now, if you take all those critical components out, and suddenly move children from classroom to a home setting, and then disconnect them from their friends, and then face-to-face setup with teachers to a home environment which is so unequal, and where the burden now, as you rightly put, shifts from teachers to mothers to look after, to monitor, to manage, and to guide students to cope with lessons that teachers give. So that's an enormous shift of responsibility. And also, let's not forget that our teachers are professionals. They are trained to look after children. Many from B40 communities, many women are mothers without formal education or very little training regarding how to guide children in times of distress. If they are having psychological problems, if their mental health is on the decline, how to keep them engaged in learning activity. And this is where I suppose, this was an enormous, shift of educational responsibility, not just in terms of resources, but also in terms of training and capability.
Niaz, it seems like, this was, as everybody used the expression, an unprecedented crisis. So perhaps preparation for it was difficult. But we saw in many countries the choice not to close schools precisely because of these reasons, right? The lack of infrastructure, the presumptions that go behind having a school, as it were, schooling from home. Were we wrong? Was the ministry and the government wrong in closing the schools and for closing them for so long? I think Melissa mentioned 35 weeks earlier. Singapore closed their schools for 4 weeks. Why do you think we did this, and what was driving those decisions? Do you have any sense of that?
So, yes, I mean, this is, you know, a really good question. And, you know, I wouldn't necessarily sort of, you know, call this a mistake on part of the government, but certainly we could have done much better. What was critical for the schools to reopen and, you know, for children to be in the classroom was to gain trust of parents and learners, to assure them that they will be safe, you know, if they're in school, and there will be, you know, a better protection of their mental health, their physical health, it will be a clean environment, but also one where there is enough provision for counseling and all of that. And I suppose it is in the absence of those measures that, you know, there was not enough popular pressure, if you like, from parents on the government to open up the education system. And again, you know, one way to get around this problem would have been to prioritize teachers and students for vaccination purpose, to send out a signal to every Malaysian that, look, education comes first. Our education is just as important as health, and, you know, schools, learners remain our priority. And if that was achieved, I'm sure everyone would have responded so positively, and the pressure, the political pressure on the government would have increased as well to reopen school. I suppose that's where there was kind of a lack of coordination. And also, I think it's our lack of appreciation of the value of education. I think that is another aspect that added to this, lapse in decision, because, you know, at the time when the government was making this decision, the government didn't consider data and evidence. But soon it became very clear, based on studies done on other countries, that the disruption caused to schooling is going to cause trillions of, you know, dollar loss in terms of future lifelong earning when we take into account the global disruption to education. And even for Malaysia, the numbers are quite striking. So I suppose if the government considered the dollar cost of school closure, perhaps there would have been a greater sense of urgency. So I suppose these are the two aspects that combine to kind of, deprioritize school reopening in the government.
Yes, you've brought up so many interesting points. We're going to have to take a quick break, but let's come back and continue this conversation and pull at some of those points that you've raised. We're going to take a quick break here and consider this, but we will be back with more, so stay tuned. Thank you so much for staying with Sharad and I on Consider This. Let's continue our conversation with Dr. Amnias Asadullah. He's a professor of economics at University of Malaya. He recently completed a study to measure the efficacy of PDPR. It's titled Homeschooling During COVID-19 Pandemic in Malaysia. Yes, let's come back to some of the things that you brought up just before the break. And one of the things that I'm curious about is I know that you looked at other countries, particularly developing countries, and how they had their own particular iterations of PDPR when, you know, they had their school closures. So I'm just wondering, for you, what were some of the markers of high quality PDPR that you saw in other developing countries? Not developed, I mean, you know, that's a certain standard, but for our neighbors around us, what were the options that they chose?
So first of all, let me be fair to Malaysia. I mean, this has been a challenge for governments all around the world. Because we are all so new into this, that, well, you know, delivering, you know, education online. So therefore, the challenges we have in experience in Malaysia are, in a way, shared challenges. The lapses that I've talked about are not necessarily unique to Malaysia. And let me again put this in a larger global context. Even before the pandemic, there was this, you know, global concern over learning crisis, meaning that even in normal times when schools were open, you know, in so many countries, millions of children were attending school and graduating without learning. So they had diploma, but not literacy. And even from Malaysia, let me share one piece of statistic that, well, you know, after, you know, at the age of 10, little over 12% Malaysians children are unable to read a sentence. So that was the baseline scenario. So therefore, you know, we have always struggled to kind of find the magic bullet, how to make sure that schooling translates into learning in the normal, you know, scenario where everything is in order. The school is open, the teacher is inside the classroom, all the provisions, gadgets are being made available, and you have a normal environment back at home, your parents are not in distress. Now, when you take away all of those, you know, parameters, it's an enormously challenging environment. And then what happened therefore was that, well, you know, we had to reinvent and repurpose the existing infrastructure to promise learning continuity. So therefore, you know, the evidence I've shared with you, the fact that even many schools did not offer online lesson, is not just specific to Malaysia. This has been reported from many other countries in South, you know, Southeast Asia, including India. So therefore, you know, again, the point I made about students not finding it easy to follow some of the online programs, or that the effectiveness is lacking, similar design problems in terms of content mismatch has been also reported in other countries, where Malaysia, unfortunately, you know, fell off from other countries is in terms of, you know, real-time improvement in practice and policy by gathering real-time data on service users, in this case, parents and learners. So there was no feedback loop.
Yes, is that how a government or a Ministry of Education would determine whether students are still learning? Because I'm just wondering, you know, taking into account what you said about whether, you know, online schooling actually translates to learning, how would teachers assess how well the students are learning online? Would that only have to wait till schools reopen and they're doing classes face to face once again to understand the scope of learning loss?
Okay, so let me you know, slightly break it down for you. Before we can think of learning, we have to ensure that, you know, students are engaged in learning activity. And, you know, that is another big, you know, part of the story that went missing, that, you know, we didn't set as a target or as an indicator, you know, which would ensure that, well, students spend X amount of hours per day in learning activity. So, of course, you know, if you're not spending time learning at home or studying, well, you know, it's no surprise that, well, there might be a dip in your test scores or your learning outcomes, right? So, and therefore, this has been the part that could have been done better to make sure that regardless of how much children learn at home under PDPR, everyone spends enough time in learning activity. And again, based on my data, what I have seen from Malaysia is that, well, you know, only for 65% children, there has been a net increase in time spent in learning activity at home during PDPR. So therefore, now for another 35% students, there was no net change in time that they would have spent at home in learning activity.
Niaz, if I could just focus on the ways in which our education system thinks about learning. I think even in the reopening of schools, the emphasis seems to be on children, you know, who are doing national level exams, for instance, and that exams might be a good marker or indicator of, you know, learning that's happened. But I mean, in somebody working in this field, would you trust test scores, especially because test scores can be manipulated, as I understand, how do we make those assessments? What would your recommendations be to policymakers going forward in terms of the assessment of the damage done and remedial measures that need to be taken?
Thank you. Well, you know, again, long before the pandemic, this has been a matter of much debate in Malaysia that how good are SPM, STPM scores? And by now we know that they're very noisy. Someone with a pass degree from these national exams can easily be, without much literacy and numeracy. And that is kind of very clear when you look at Malaysia's poor performance in PISA and TIMSS, that, well, you know, at a time when our national pass rates are going up, we are kind of stuck in the bottom third of the global distribution of PISA and TIMSS, where there is a much more objective measure of learning in multiple domains using metrics that are globally comparable. So therefore, you know, I suppose what you're hinting at is kind of a reform of our assessment system, perhaps to introduce competency-based assessments where we don't reward students or grade them for rote learning or memorization. Rather, we genuinely assess their competency in terms of reasoning ability, critical thinking ability, and so on. And again, perhaps what the pandemic will do is to kind of bring forward this, in the policy agenda and for the government to prioritize this, because I could not agree more with you. If we cannot get the diagnosis right, we cannot design the right remedial policy. So therefore, you know, it is in everyone's interest to make sure that we correctly measure the depth of learning loss, and we make that information available to everyone so that we can then design and approve the necessary measures that would help remedy the gap and then help catch up students who have fallen behind.
May I pick up on that and ask you, I mean, you know, based on what you've observed and found in your study, what is it that you're hoping that policymakers bear in mind? What are you hoping to see to ensure that future interventions, when it comes, you know, if something like this should happen again, how do we ensure that we're doing our children right, that we're making sure that, you know, no time is lost, that education is not being put on the back burner? What would you like to see, Nias?
Well, I want to see that, you know, I want to see a more agile and flexible and responsive education system, one that kind of takes stock of the entire learning landscape, where, you know, we realize and recognize that learning is not just about activities in the classroom. A lot of, it happens when students return at home. Even their performance in the classroom depends on how, you know, they are treated at home. And that, you know, is therefore bringing up the role of other agents within the education sector that we don't, you know, prioritize and think about. I want to particularly single out mothers who are so critical for ensuring home learning, be it during school closure or during, the normal time when schools function. Globally, the science endorses the role of mothers, how critical they are, and how they can complement efforts made by teachers in the classroom to make it more productive. Schools do and teachers do in the classroom. So I suppose this is, you know, really where we need to rethink about the broader role of family, because in Malaysia, I see so much discussion and debate about digital divide, but I rarely see any discussion on parental divide. The enormous inequality that exists in parental capability to assist, to guide, and to nurture children, be that in times of crisis or be that in normal times, to excel, to perform well in school, that, you know, that is the missing part. You know, I don't see enough government programs to improve parental capability by giving counseling, raising parental awareness, and also, let's not forget, improving digital literacy among parents. Because this has been another feedback from the students I interviewed when some of them wrote notes that, well, you know, they had difficulty communicating with their parents. Some parents had difficulty understanding what children were doing online, and that created a lot of discord. The other part that I want to bring up again with a focus on mother is to empower parents in a way so that they can act as whistleblowers. What does it mean? Well, you know, going back to my finding that so many teachers did not show up. The school authorities did not offer online lessons. So someone has to hold the teachers accountable, but someone has to first report that, hey, my child's school is not running an online session. So I suppose we need to give voice to parents so that, well, they become much more involved and they're duly recognized as a key player in educational development. And the last point, of course, is to address the issue of unequal, you know, resource gap at home, digital divide, cyber infrastructure.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us on the show today and sharing the findings of your survey. We appreciate your time. That was our conversation with education economist Professor Emnias Asadullah. And that wraps up our episode of Consider This for tonight. Thank you so much for watching. I'm Melissa Idris.
And I'm Sharad Kutan, signing off for the evening.
Have a lovely weekend, folks. See you soon.